From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. People haven't always used effervescent color tablets to dye Easter eggs. The Ukrainian art of egg decorating dates back more than 1,000 years. Sofika Zelik is an artist who lives in New York and specializes in the art form. I first interviewed her back in 2007, but because of what's happening now in Ukraine, I thought it was important to revisit the culture of these eggs. Hi, Sofika.
Hello.
I just want to say formally that I am just devastated and so sorry for what you and your friends and family who live in Ukraine are going through.
Thank you. It is horrific. We have family in Ukraine. My parents came to the U.S. as refugees after World War II, and they always talked about their experiences, but when I see all the pictures and all the videos on TV, now I know exactly what they went through. And seeing my distant relatives going through the same thing in Ukraine right now is just heartbreaking. I never, ever thought that this would happen. So thank you very, very much. And, you know, I thank all the people all around the world for their support. It truly means a lot.
Are you finding any kind of solace in your work?
Absolutely. In the first few days when Russia invaded, I, as everybody else, was glued to the TV and constantly emailing my friends, my relatives in Ukraine and so forth. I couldn't do any work. It was as if I was going through the stages of grief, which I think actually that was. First, it was shock, disbelief. Then it was utter sadness. And then it was rage. And I think when I was in the rage phase, I sat down at my work table and I started doing an egg, and that calmed me down. And I just went into this meditative state, if you can call it that. And it truly helps right now. I feel connected with the people there. I don't know how else to explain it, but it's like this little thread from New York, from the East Village, all the way to the poor people of Ukraine at this point.
You recently said in an Instagram post, everyone defends themselves with weapons they know best, and as a Pisanka artist, my weapon is an ordinary egg.
Yes. There is a very, very old pre-Christian legend that says there is an awful monster chained up in the Carpathian Mountains. This is in Western Ukraine. And each year he sends out his spies into the world to see if people are creating pisanke. If people are creating the pisanke, which is the Ukrainian word for Ukrainian Easter eggs. So if people are creating these pisanke, the spies come back and tighten the monster's chains. But if the spies don't come back because people are not making pisanke, the chains become looser and looser. Eventually, the monster will get free and it will be the end of the world. So I actually started a project at the Ukrainian Institute of America here in New York. I put out on social media a post about this legend and about this monster who is evil personified, and we all know who that is right now. And I am asking everybody who cares to make one traditional design, a traditional pisanka design, and send it to the Ukrainian Institute for an art installation. And this is my way of defeating the monster, of defeating evil personified.
So moving. For people who have never seen a Ukrainian decorated egg, can you describe what they look like, the colors, the designs, and the history of those designs?
Well, this is an extremely ancient tradition. In pagan times, our ancestors lived with nature and according to nature. Anything they could not explain, they explained by the power of nature spirits. And eventually those spirits became personified and pagan gods were born. Now, in the winter time, people thought that the god of the sun was leaving them because the days grew shorter and the nights grew longer. So they had a spring ritual to bring back the sun. They chose an egg as a gift to the sun for a few reasons. Number one, birds fly higher in the air. They're much closer to the sun than people were. So when the people held an egg in their hands, they thought they could harness a little bit of the power of the sun. Number two, the yolk reminded the people of the sun, so it was the sun's image. And the third reason was that the sun god had a chosen creature. It was the rooster. The rooster crows, the sun comes out, so the sun god only listened to the rooster. And what the people did, they included symbols of tribute and symbols of different prayers in the hopes that the sun god would grant them the wishes. So, for example, if they drew a chick, it was fertility. A pine branch is health. Flowers, happiness. Deer are prosperity and strength. The star, Rosette, which is an eight-pointed star, was the symbol of the almighty sun god. And this tradition was passed down from mother to daughter in secret so that nobody else could see you creating a pisanka because they might cast an evil eye on the design and the sun god would not grant them the wish. There's so much symbolism in history. And then when Ukraine adopted Christianity in the 10th century AD, this tradition was incorporated into the Christian religion. So very often one symbol has a double meaning, the pagan and the Christian. For example, the cross equal on all four sides was the symbol of the sun himself. And as Christianity grew more and more important, the horizontal bar went up and it became the Christian cross. And now these eggs are known as Easter eggs for Easter. But in pagan times, it was a spring ritual of rebirth of nature, of getting the sun back.
How old were you when you first learned how to decorate the egg?
Yeah, I was about 5 or 6, then I actually made my first egg. And I remember falling asleep and watching my mother sitting at the desk with a candle, an egg, and a stylus. And it was so peaceful, so magical that I remember it till this day. And then when I was about 5, I remember climbing up on my mother's lap and together we created an egg. And I mean together because this is done with hot wax, a candle, a stylus, a hot wax. So a 5-year-old, it's sort of dangerous. But I remember that design. It was just stars, lines, circles. I remember that moment very well.
So it's a wax resist method on a hollow eggshell, correct?
Yes and no. It's a wax resistance method on an egg that is full inside.
Really?
Yes. Traditionally, there was no point in making the designs on an eggshell because there's life inside the egg. And the yolk reminded the people of the sun. So if you blow out the inside, you don't have the power of the sun anymore. So it was very important to leave the yolk inside. And eventually the yolk dries out inside. So it really is no problem. But you're correct. It's batik on an egg.
And what kind of dyes do you use?
Well, in olden days, these were strictly passed down from mother to daughter. These were secret dyes of roots, berries, flowers, nuts even. But now these are special chemical dyes made especially for these types of eggs.
Do mothers and daughters get together every year and do them? And if you get gifted an egg, do you ever eat it? Do you ever crack off the design and eat the egg? Or are they kept as keepsakes throughout the years?
Well, you can't eat what's inside because it's not hard-boiled. Originally, these eggs, pisanki, were not meant to be kept for a long time. There were uses for them. During the Lenten season, of course, they were made. And then as the Easter season approached, they were gifted to other people. And of course, there are rules on who to give which egg. For example, if a woman or somebody is sickly, they would get a pine branch for health. A boy would get strength and prosperity, which is either a deer or a rooster. after the Easter season, there were uses for them. They were ground up in cattle feed so that the cattle would be healthier. The shells would be buried in gardens so that there would be a better harvest. An egg with an eternity symbol was put in beehives so there would be continuous honey. When a house was being built, an egg was put on the four corners of the house so that no evil spirit would come. Actually, when a young child died during the Easter season, a pisanka was placed in the coffin so that the child would have something to play with. There are all these traditions on what to do with the eggs. Of course, now they're works of art and they can be kept year after year. But traditionally, no, every year new eggs were made.
Has your art changed over the years?
Yes and no. I love doing the traditional designs. By traditional designs, when people started immigrating, they brought with them all their traditions. But eventually they forgot the symbolism. And the emphasis now was not on the symbols themselves, but on the perfection of the designs. I started doing what are known as the diaspora eggs, which are eggs that are very intricate and you try to do them perfectly. That's the way I started. And then I started delving into the history of these eggs and I saw what the traditional designs were like. And I started doing that. So I researched the designs that are very old, you can say ancient even. And I also continued doing the diaspora designs, but what I'm starting to do now, I lived in Ukraine in 2014 to 2015. I was fortunate enough to receive a Fulbright grant. And I was researching how folk art influenced Ukrainian fine artists of the early 20th century. Somebody like Sonia Delaney, Kazimir Malevich. I started to create egg designs in their artistic style. However, I could not do anything if I had not first researched the traditional designs.
They're really extraordinary, and I encourage everyone who's listening to you to go to your website, sofika.com, to look at what you create, not just on chicken eggs, but on large ostrich, on larger canvas, so to speak, larger
yes.
eggs, and also ceramics.
Yes, I do ceramics as well. My mother taught me. My mother taught me how to do the eggs and the ceramics.
I can't thank you enough for coming to join us again, Sofika, after so long. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you. It was truly a pleasure speaking to you. I would like to thank you again for your support. Everybody who comes up to me and says, I'm sorry, or I'm hoping this will end soon. It means so much because we are basically powerless here. But I can do my eggs, and I thank everybody for their support.
That's Pisanka artist Sofika Zielek. To see a picture of her absolutely gorgeously decorated eggs, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You can also see more of her work at her website, sofika.com. That's sofika.com. Coming up, Ramadan Mubarak. We discuss how to host iftar.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Ramadan is the holiest month of the year for Muslims. The month-long observance includes fasting between sunrise and sunset. Iftar, the evening meal that breaks the fast, is anticipated all day, and hosting this dinner can be a recipe for added pressure and stress. Bon Appetit food editor Zainab Issa shares her house rules. Hi, Zainab.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming, even though you're fasting.
I'm definitely hungry.
Yes. Well, I'm hungry too. So I'm in solidarity with you. When is Ramadan this year?
So it's from April 1st to May 2nd this year.
Can you explain its importance?
Yeah, sure. So for a lot of Muslims, it's a time to like reconnect virtually through the practice of fasting and just spending more time focusing on our beliefs. For me, it's like a reset. I think throughout the year, I sort of fall off and then I use this time to come back into it and practice gratitude. And for me, that's the biggest thing out of the month, especially with fasting. It's always a reminder of how grateful I am for food and how fleeting eating can be. As in, when I break my fast, I've been thinking about food the entire day. And after literally 10 minutes of eating, I'm like fully satiated and I'm like, oh my God, wow. That's all it took. So yeah, I think there's a lot of significance there beyond just not eating. There are like definitely scientific benefits towards fasting that come into play. But I think for me personally, it's more about reminding myself of the pleasure of food and being grateful and using the opportunity to connect a little bit more spiritually.
How do you know what time you're allowed to begin eating again each day?
So a lot of people will just look outside when the sun sort of passes over your head is when they say it's safe to eat again. So sunset, there's also a lot of timetables that a lot of mosques will provide to their community members if you just want like an easy resource.
And why is the fast traditionally broken with dates?
So I think that's a tradition of the Prophet. He used to break his fast with dates. They instantly rebalance blood sugar. So there's the health benefit there. Okay, you're probably exhausted from lack of food throughout the day. And those dates just pick you right back up.
How old were you when you began to fast each Ramadan?
I think my parents sort of started encouraging us with like half fasts. So we would sort of spend 1 or 2 weekends in the month of Ramadan fasting from like the morning until 3 p.m., just sort of to get used to it. And then you're officially supposed to begin fasting when you hit puberty. So I've been fasting full sort of before that, just because I liked the community aspect of it. I liked doing it with the rest of my family. So I started fasting probably when I was 8.
Do you find that it gets easier as the month goes on?
Yes, for sure. The first week is definitely the most challenging. A lot of other Muslims will also tell you that fasting outside of the month of Ramadan is extremely difficult. But for whatever reason, within this month, when everybody else is doing it, it is way easier than otherwise.
So let's talk about iftar, this evening meal that you break the fast with.
Yeah.
Is it typically celebratory, like with a group of people, and it's kind of a feasting meal?
It can be. I think on weekends, when people tend to get together, it definitely leans more that way. But for a lot of people, it's not even a full meal. For me personally, in my family and community, it is. But a lot of people will sort of just have dates and some small snacks or appetizers to break their fast, then go pray, and then come back for a full dinner that they wouldn't consider their iftar. For me, iftar is dinner. I usually will break my fast, eat a full meal, and then go pray, for example.
What have you learned from being a guest at other people's iftar celebrations?
Oh my God, so much. The most important thing being always keep a dish for date pits. The amount of times I've been walking around someone's house with my half-eaten date pit that's like has my spit on it and looking for the garbage can is way too many times to count.
I love that. It's such a niche need, but important.
It's very niche. Like, where's your garbage can? They're like, do you really need to ask right now? I'm like pouring hot soup into a bowl. I'm like, okay, sorry.
If we've been invited to an iftar celebration, is there a type of food gift one should bring?
I definitely think ask your host. So they'll tell you what they don't like to make, and they'll probably make you bring that.
Yeah, like any other potluck.
Yes, exactly.
you have some house rules for hosting iftar, beginning with what you call no surprises.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you let people know in advance what you'll be serving?
It's definitely like reflective of my personal preferences. I need to know what I'm eating always. So I just think it's polite and nice. And why wouldn't someone want something to look forward to?
Also, I would imagine that if you're thinking about food all day long and you're going to somebody's house, it sort of tamps down the anxiety of not knowing what you're going to have once you get there.
Yeah. And for a lot of people who have dietary preferences too, it's super helpful. One of my cousins was vegan for a while, and that conversation was always helpful because I knew what to make her. And if I wasn't making anything vegan, she would be like, oh my God, I'll bring something vegan for myself and others. Don't worry.
I've been cooking my whole life. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty good at knowing how to season food even without tasting it. But I would imagine that that can be a challenge if you are a person who's not spent years and years in the kitchen or who isn't professional. Because when you're cooking during the day for people to arrive later, you're fasting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's extremely challenging. And it's definitely something that I used to harp on is like, you know, am I going to feed people food that's delicious? And so much of that is adequately seasoning with salt. So I always will lean on recipes. While usually I'd be a little bit more free in the kitchen, but leaning on recipes when I'm hosting other people is definitely something I do just because I feel way more comfortable serving someone something that I know will be good.
Do you ever have anxiety watching your guests' first few bites?
Oh my God, always. My heart beats super fast. I'm like waiting for the comment to come out of their mouth. I sometimes will like try and sneak a bite really quickly so that I can avoid that. But if I can't, I'm just sort of watching patiently.
What will you be serving this year? Do you tend to pick a dish and lean on it heavily each year?
No, definitely not. I like variety. So I definitely every night will try and eat something different. And then when it comes to like eating leftovers, that'll be for my like pre-dawn meal known as sehri. When I'm hosting people, I definitely like to follow more of a pattern than when I'm eating regularly. It's definitely more of a big deal hosting an iftar as opposed to just eating iftar at home with my husband. I always like to draw on traditional meals and also work in some stuff that I've come to know and love through just living in America my whole life.
So give us an idea, paint a picture of one of your iftar meals you'll be doing this month.
I have a perpetual craving for Afghan mantu. My Afghan friends make it and I especially eat it during Ramadan. And I was like, okay, I don't think I'm going to have the energy before fasting to make the filling mixture, then like make the dough, roll it out, fill each one, steam it, then make a tomato sauce, then make a yogurt sauce, then assemble just a lot while you're hungry and low energy. So I was thinking about ways that I could simplify the process, and through that came stuffed shells. And when I was testing and developing that, I found that like it was a bit tricky in terms of there was one too many pots and there was still the element of filling individual things, which felt like a bit too much work as well. So then I pivoted to what I thought was a new idea. And I shared it with my friend. I was like, what if instead of shells, I just did regular pasta in a spiced meat sauce? And she was like, you mean Afghan pasta? I was like, oh, okay. So that's what I'm going to be making, definitely. It's super simple. You just sort of make a bolognese style sauce. It gets spiced with some cumin and coriander. And it's super delicious with pappardelle. That's how I like to eat it. And then the star is really this garlicky, minty yogurt sauce that brightens everything up. I remember when my editor tried it, he was like, what's the acid in this? Literally nothing. It's just like so nice and bright. And that raw garlic sort of adds this spice in the background that's super nice. So I'm definitely the most excited about that one.
I love mantu, which are, we should say it's like a stuffed pasta, kind of like a ravioli, but not a ravioli.
Exactly, like a spiced meat-filled stuffed dumpling situation.
Yeah, and with the two different sauces on top, it's just chef's kiss for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you make your own desserts?
Oh, always. I love desserts personally, and I think that especially if you're like hosting an iftar in sort of a more elaborate way, there should always be two. One that's more fresh and potentially cold, and one that's nice and hot. So deep frying in Ramadan is very traditional. It's not something growing up I wouldn't see every single day. Translating that into my own life is a little bit different because I have an apartment kitchen and I don't want to buy a deep fryer, and transferring hot oil in and out of pots is annoying. When I do deep fry, it's got to be for something special. And the one thing that's super exclusive to Ramadan for my family was kalimati. So they're an East African donut that's made with yogurt. So they get super tender, almost like mochi. They get one rise. You don't really need the dough. And I like to use a cookie scoop to sort of put them into the oil, kind of organically and easy, no mess. And then they get a cardamom spiced sugar syrup at the end, and I just can eat them like straight. They don't even make it to the table most of the time.
Oh, that sounds so good. I feel like I need to apologize for torturing you.
No, this is my favorite thing. My boss was asking me the same thing, and I'm like, no, I would be doing this regardless.
That sounds wonderful. Well, people coming to your house for iftar will be very lucky. Thank you so much.
Of course.
That was Zainab Issa. She's a food editor at Bon Appetit and a freelance recipe developer. To read her tips on hosting iftar, you can visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Trading in a life on Wall Street, Lisa Steele gave into her DNA as a fifth-generation chicken keeper. She founded the blog Fresh Eggs Daily, which has been viewed more than 50 million times. With Easter just around the corner, we thought it was a perfect time to catch up with her. She joins us from her home in Maine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you have snow out the view of your window?
We have a little bit under the trees and where the sun didn't shine, but we had a lot of melting the last couple of days.
Oh, good. Over a cranberry and orange muffin and a sip of coffee was when you decided to shut your briefcase and get off Wall Street. Why did you decide to return to chickens, especially since some of your early memories weren't so positive?
I think that in life, you end up exactly where you belong. And I think if you just kind of look for signs and listen to your heart and listen to your gut, I think it's something that I couldn't have avoided because I just, this is where I belong. I took a kind of a long route to get back here. And it's true, I didn't have the greatest chicken experiences as a kid, but I really love what I'm doing now. And I know it was meant to be.
You've written 6 books on raising chickens.
Yeah.
So before we get into their product, the egg, is there anything in particular you'd like to warn urbanites or share for those who are thinking about jumping into keeping chickens in the city?
Yes, obviously I could talk for hours about chickens, but in a nutshell, do some research, check your local laws to make sure that you know how many chickens you can have, if you need permits, things like that. And then just do some basic reading, figure out so you know the foundation, the basics, what you need to feed your chickens, how to keep them safe so predators don't eat them, because that's a huge problem. But other than that, they're pretty easy once you get your whole setup in place. And I highly recommend it. It's just a really fun thing to do.
You must have, eggs constantly around you. Are eggs something that your family eats every single day?
Pretty much. I mean, there are times of year when the chickens aren't laying, like in the winter, unless you have new baby chicks that just started laying. But yeah, I pretty much, I have a drawer in the fridge just dedicated to eggs, and that's pretty much where I go. Not every meal, but I think almost every meal I'm reaching for at least an egg for something.
It makes us feel better to hear that, I have to tell you, for those of us who are in love with eggs. What are some common mistakes that people make when they cook eggs?
I think the biggest mistake is cooking them too fast. Eggs cook super fast anyway, so you want to do it over low heat. And especially when you're scrambling eggs, whisk them and get them all mixed up before you even put them in the pan. Because if you crack a couple eggs in the pan and then start whisking them up, you're going to end up with those clumps of egg white because they've cooked faster than you can actually get them whisked in and incorporated.
When you scramble eggs, do you add anything to the mixture? Do you add water or cream or milk?
I don't. I know that people like to. I think that it makes the eggs watery. And I think if you have a good fresh egg, it's just going to taste delicious without anything. And there's going to be enough moisture in that egg that the egg's not going to dry out. Sometimes I don't even add salt or pepper. I just will scramble eggs and a little bit of butter and call it a day.
Sounds good. It's funny how something that simple can just get your juices flowing. How can we tell if eggs that we have in the house are fresh?
You can't tell just by looking at an egg, unfortunately. But the float test, which people who raise chickens are probably very familiar with, you fill a glass with water and gently drop your egg in. And if the egg sits on the bottom, it's super fresh. If it's starting to rise up a little bit on one end, it's starting to get a little old. And if the egg floats, it's really, really old, could possibly be bad. As an egg ages, air gets in through the pores in the eggshell, so the egg starts to get buoyant. So that's kind of a good gauge. You know, by 2 or 3 weeks or so, one end of that egg is probably going to start lifting up off the bottom of the glass.
And what happens if we cook old eggs?
Nothing. They probably still have about the same nutrition. I've read that eggs don't really lose a lot of nutrition as they age, but you're going to lose some of the texture because the egg has lost a lot of moisture. The white is going to be runny. A lot of the protein bonds break down. So if you crack an old egg into a frying pan, for example, it's just going to spread all over the place. It's not going to stay in one place like it should.
Since your life is so egg-focused, I'm curious about what happens when Easter rolls around. Is there a huge dyeing gathering, a hunt? And what's always on the table on the day?
You know, it's really funny because I grew up with chickens also, and I never remember looking for real eggs. We used those little plastic eggs that you can put something inside of. I mean, even as a kid, we never actually hunted for real eggs, which is pretty funny. We did dye them, but I do actually like dyeing eggs. I don't think that it necessarily has to be something that just kids do. And I love using vegetable dyes. So like beet greens or spinach, turmeric, blueberries, like there's all kinds of things you can make natural dyes with. And the eggs come out really pretty.
You know, you have a recipe for turmeric deviled eggs that looks like the perfect thing for an Easter brunch.
I love that recipe. That came about because I wanted to include a pickled egg recipe in the cookbook. And a lot of the recipes used beets, and I don't love the red pickled egg look. And then I found a recipe that used the turmeric, so they turned out yellow instead. And I thought, how cool would that be to basically pickle your eggs in a turmeric solution so the outside of the egg white turns yellow, but then turn them into deviled eggs? And I did that, and I just love that. I think if you brought that for Easter, people would absolutely adore it.
And I know that you have a bread that you make that has an Easter variation.
Yes, and I'm so sad that that photo didn't get into the cookbook. You know, you can't have a photo for every recipe, but a traditional Finnish pula bread, which is like a challah or, you know, a braided bread that my family makes for Easter, you know, when I was young, and then now I do as well to carry on the tradition. But you can also tuck some eggs into the braid and then bake it like that, raw eggs. So then the eggs cook as the bread is baking. And that's also really pretty for your Easter table. And using the plant dyes obviously is safer, you know, because you're not using food coloring and it's not getting into your bread.
It would also be pretty to just use naturally colored eggs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you have chickens that lay green or blue eggs, that's what I usually do because we do have the different colored eggs.
What's your absolute favorite way to prepare eggs?
The cover should be a hint, although it was completely coincidental. But if I could only eat eggs one way for the rest of my life, it would absolutely be Eggs Benedict. I just love hollandaise sauce, and I don't think you can beat a really good Eggs Benedict.
Well, I know what I'm going to have to be in search of soon. Thank you so much. It's a marvelous book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Lisa Steele, known as the Queen of the Coop. We've been discussing all of the uses for the incredible edible egg. You'll find one of her recipes on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. For more recipes, check out the Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook. In a minute, the intersection of Jewish and Italian cuisines, just in time for Passover. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. As a Jew, who is basically an adopted Italian, I've always been fascinated by the history of Jews in Italy and how food transmits these stories. I'm so happy to get to talk to Benedetta Guetta, whose new book, Cooking alla Giudia, is the first book in a while to cover this cuisine. Hi, Benedetta.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So who are the Italian Jews?
That's a really good question. Most Italians don't really know the answer to that question. There aren't many Italian Jews. There's like about 45,000 of us, probably less as of right now. Those are like old numbers. And we're a very small community within Italy. People in Italy can go their whole life without ever meeting a Jew or ever realizing that they met one. Yet we exist and we have over 2,000 years of history because Jews have lived in Italy from the very beginning of times, from approximately the Roman Empire. They exist. They have a really long story, which I thought was worth writing about because it's not very well known abroad and in Italy itself either.
Where did they come from? And did they come on their own agency or were they brought there?
Jews arrived in Italy at about the time of the Judean Wars from Jerusalem. They were mostly brought in as slaves. So no, they didn't come out of their own will. They mostly arrived as a result of the political conflicts that Rome had at the time in Judea, what we today call Israel. They had different fortunes over the years. There were centuries and times when they were in political favor, so they lived in relative peace with the country and with its inhabitants. And there were times where the struggle was harder because there were people in power that didn't like them, didn't like their religion, and then they were persecuted. So as it often happens with Jews, they had alternate fortunes through history in Italy.
And were part of the Jewish communities made up of Jews from Spain who were expelled?
There was for sure a big flow of Jews that emigrated from Spain and Portugal. But there was also, like I said, this whole authentic Italian heritage to the Jews of Italy. Way before we started to distinguish between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews, Italian Jews had their own traditions and their own culture. In fact, even in terms of food, the food of the Jews of Italy looks nothing like what we call American Ashkenazi food or Sephardi food as we know it.
So let's talk about the foods, which I find to be completely fascinating. You hear stories occasionally about things like artichokes and eggplant being linked to the Jewish community. But can you tell us some of the stories that are behind that?
So the thing about Jewish Italian food is that you wouldn't think that some dishes are Jewish of origin, but they really are. And when you talk about Italian food, it's very easy to, you know, cover it all with one broad brush and talk about pizza and cannoli and whatever. But there is a point in which the Jewish culture and the Italian cuisine interact and intersect. And this is the point that I tried to explore in my book. You mentioned eggplants. That's a really good story. When we think of Italian food, eggplant always comes to mind. But Italians had no idea of what eggplants were until the 18th century. They thought that eggplants were some sort of poisonous thing that grew from the earth. And that was, I'm quoting from actual history books, a food for the Jews and for the dogs. It was only because the Jews brought eggplants within their cuisine that eventually Italians absorbed it and learned to cook with it. Otherwise, they would have never had this ingredient to begin with. And that's just one of the examples of how these two cultures touched each other and then went on to evolve in their own different directions, but with one common history at the bottom of it all. To give you another funny story, there's this shape of pasta called orecchiette. And everybody in Italy, anywhere in the country, they'll tell you that this shape of pasta comes from the southern region of Apulia. No one ever realizes that orecchiette actually didn't come from Apulia. They came from southern France and they were brought by the Jews around the 12th century. So it's like one of those things when you're like, you really ignored the story. And as of today, there is like so many of these stories and bits and pieces that are just not known. And that was sort of my mission.
You know, it's so interesting. Whenever I'm in Sicily eating a million different variations of caponata, I always think of caponata as something that must have a Jewish origin.
It does indeed. Of course, the eggplant, like I said, it's one of those ingredients that give away the Jewish origin when we're talking about Italy. But also the fact that many traditional dough recipes have raisins. Raisins were another classic ingredient that the Jews put in every single one of their dishes. So the presence of eggplant and raisins and a few other hints allow us to determine that it was a dish of Jewish origin.
Yeah, definitely the sweet and sour character of it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Passover. I would love to know what happens to pasta during Passover in Italy. Does it disappear completely, or is there some sort of détente that Italian Jews have made with flour for the purposes of pasta?
Well, that's a very valid question. First of all, you need to imagine that Italians can't really live without pasta. So there are a few different ways we work around it for Passover. The most common solution is we make, for example, lasagna by using matzah sheets. You just put your matzah to soak it in broth and then you treat it like as if it was pasta. So that's literally the number one way to overcome the pasta prohibition. In addition to that, historically, there was another tradition that is now a bit lost, as in very few families still do it. There's a pasta dish called sfoglietti, which was substantially a little like concoction, like a dough made with flour and water that was made so fast and pressed so quickly and then burnt over an open fire that it was believed to not have time to rise. Therefore, it would not break the Passover prohibitions. So the Jews used to make this sort of really burnt, thin, crispy pasta that then they would cook during the week of Passover, but they would make it ahead of the holiday. Now, this tradition has been a bit lost because in order to do it, you really need to find what is called the kosher for Passover flour. So a flour that has been monitored from the very beginning, from when the grains are harvested all the way to when the flour is actually ground under rabbinical supervision. And that is very hard to find these days.
So describe the kind of Passover lasagna that you make.
There's two things that you need to make sure that your lasagna is kosher in general and kosher for Passover. Being Jewish comes with a lot of rules. One of the many rules that we can't break is that we don't mix in the same dish meat and milk. Italians cook their bolognese on the one hand, and then they make their bechamel sauce and they assemble them in the lasagna. And the bechamel is generally made with milk. The way we overcome that issue as Jews so that we don't have to give up on our lasagna is to make our bolognese sauce the traditional way and then to make bechamel with broth instead of milk. However, on Passover, we also need to make sure that we don't use flour in our bechamel. So to overcome that further complication, we can use rice flour that's allowed for Passover.
Is matzah used in soup in a way that isn't the matzah ball that many of us who are Ashkenazi are familiar with?
Yes, actually, we don't really have matzah balls. Matzah balls of Ashkenazi origin are sometimes found in Italy, in the northern part of the country, for example, close to Venice, where they do prepare them on occasions. But I think you can grow your whole life in Italy as a Jew and never have a matzah ball. What we do with matzah is we make a Passover soup called dayenu, which has matzah broken into pieces and sprinkled inside the soup to make it thicker and, you know, richer. You can also cook matzah in a runny, I'm going to say, tomato sauce, like not a thick one yet, but with water, so that it eventually absorbs the water and it has somehow the texture of a pasta. That takes a bit of imagination to think of it in terms of pasta, but it's close enough.
What would be a Passover entree that you would make?
To tell you the truth, we don't do entrees much. Especially for Passover, you would generally have a big spread of different dishes. So what I would do for Passover, one of my favorite dishes, the lamb. Passover comes in the spring, and we generally make lamb with spring vegetables, such as artichokes or fava beans, or the two combined. So that would be one of those dishes that I feature often on Passover. The thing about Passover that I find the most exciting when it comes to cooking is not really the savory dishes, it's the dessert. Because as a cook, you really want to find a way to make Passover desserts that are as yummy as non-Passover desserts.
So tell us about the pizzarelle.
In the Roman Jewish tradition, they use pizza very loosely. There is obviously no relationship to pizza, despite the fact that we call them pizzarelle. But pizzarelle are like tiny fritters made of matzah and eggs, obviously, and then you can add raisins or cocoa or whatever else you want to add in there, that are deep fried in olive oil and that are served with a drizzle of honey or syrup. Pizzarelle are just the simplest of things. You take the matzah, you soak it, you squish it, and you make it into little balls.
What about the almond snake?
Oh, that's a really interesting topic that takes us to another region of Italy, the region of Marche. Jews have historically been consuming almonds a lot. They consumed a great deal of almonds in different forms, marzipan being one of the very common ones, especially for Passover. Almond flour allows you to bake and cook. So naturally, this ingredient was very present in our culinary tradition. And the marzipan snake is the marzipan dough, which we prepare for Passover. And the story about it is somewhat interesting because there's the story of Joseph when he goes to meet the Pharaoh and he has a stick, like a walking stick, that he bangs on the floor and the walking stick turns into a snake, scaring the Egyptian Pharaoh. So the shape of the snake is supposed to remind us of this story.
I understand that you recently opened a cafe here in Santa Monica. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, that's actually super exciting. Back in October, I started this tiny business. It's a tiny coffee shop that also has a kitchen to it. And what we do there is we serve challah. One of my obsessions besides Jewish Italian food is challah. I love challah. I bake it a lot. So what we do in my coffee shop, which is called Cafe Lovi, we make challah sandwiches. That's our signature thing. We call ourselves the House of Challah.
What a delight to meet you. Thank you so much, Benedetta.
Thank you very, very much. It's been my pleasure.
That's Santa Monica-based food writer and photographer Benedetta Jasmine Goeta. Her cookbook is Cooking Alla Judia. She also owns and runs Cafe Lovi at Broadway and 19th in Santa Monica. Up next, Tahoe Gold tangerines make a pretty sweet dessert. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims for the Market Report. I'm here today at the Santa Monica Farmer's Market with Naomi Shim Pateo, chef owner of Doubting Thomas in Filipino Town. Good morning, Naomi.
Good morning.
So we're here today to talk about tangerines and a wonderful dish that I've had several times at Doubting Thomas, your tangerine roll. Can you tell me about that dish and how you came up with it?
Well, I conceived it at Salt's Cure about 10 years ago. We used brioche dough back then, and it was kind of like a cinnamon roll, but with tangerine zest and tangerine juice.
Yum, that sounds delicious. Can you walk me through the process of how is the zest and juice incorporated into the dish?
Well, now we use Cresanto, and then we zest the tangerines first, and we incorporate that into the filling, and then we make a glaze. I caramelize some sugar and butter, and then I add tangerine juice, and then I finish it off with some creme fraiche.
Can you tell me about the role that the tangerine zest and juice plays in the tangerine roll? Like, what does it bring to the dish?
It definitely cuts through the sweetness of the sugar of the glaze. And they are just so juicy right now, and they're exploding with flavor. They're definitely peaking. I bought 3 cases today from Friends Ranch. Their farm is in Ojai, and I don't know what is in their soil, but it just yields the most delicious tangerines.
So because the skin is so tender, do you chop it up? Do you zest it like a traditional orange? How do you get the zest off for the roll?
We just gently zest it, and we also finish the glaze with that. So it's in the filling, and it's also in the glaze.
If you don't have tangerines, do you ever use other citrus throughout the year for it? And if so, which ones would you use for that?
Not really, because we just put on the menu and it just came to my mind because we had so much crisanto scraps and I didn't want it to go to waste. So I kind of just like bunched it up. And one morning I rolled it up and I decided to make tangerine rolls, and it was a big hit. And so people were asking for it. So now it's a permanent thing on the menu. Of course, we'll change it up. You know, the tangerines are peaking right now, but there's always, we live in California, we live in paradise, so there's always a citrus in season. So we can, you know, perhaps do tangelo or blood orange.
Do you use the tangerines at home? Do you use them any other kind of your own cooking? Do you eat them straight? Like, how do you like to eat them when not at the restaurant?
I'll slice them up. I'll add it to like my granola and yogurt, and it's just a big treat.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Naomi.
Thank you for having me.
That was Naomi Shim Pateo, chef owner of Doubting Thomas in Filipinotown. I'm here this morning with Tony Thatcher and Emily Ayala of Friends Ranch in Ojai. Good morning, Tony. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
So we're here today. I just spoke with Chef Naomi Shim Pateo from Doubting Thomas, who uses your Tahoe Gold tangerines in a delicious tangerine roll that she makes, kind of like a cinnamon roll, but with orange zest and sugar and all that stuff. And so I wanted to talk to you guys about the Tahoe Gold tangerine specifically. So can you tell me about that fruit and where that name came from?
Well, the name came and the variety came from the University of Riverside. It's actually a triploid. It's 3 different pollinations put together. They were called TDEs originally. And it's one of 3 varieties they developed all at once. And because it's a triploid, it's seedless. And it has an excellent flavor this time of year, March, April.
They're like little bags of juice hanging on the trees is what I call them, which makes they're a very delicate piece of fruit. If the wind blows the wrong way, they fall off or get poked by stems and branches. But when you buy them, you need to be really gentle with them, like you're carrying a bag of eggs. And I juiced some up last night for a cocktail. And it's amazing how much one tangerine has. I just used 2 tangerines and made myself a glass of juice, and they're amazingly juicy.
Be sure and use the peel. The peel makes great zest, or you could slice it really thinly and put some in a cocktail or on fish or in chicken, or make a dessert, a sorbet.
Does the juice and the sweetness level kind of like change throughout the season, or just tell me about like how the fruit changes from when it begins to the end of the season?
Well, sure. Anything, if you pick it too soon, it's going to be too acidic. And as the acid goes down, the sugar content goes up. So, yes, over the 2 months or so that we actually pick them, the sugar content will go up. They will get sweeter. They will get less acidic. But it's really that balance you want. You don't want to completely lose the acidity. Otherwise, it tastes pretty bland. You want some of that acidity.
And we actually have them growing on 2 different ranches that are about 10 miles apart. And the temperature is just enough so that they ripen at different times. So the ranch we're picking right now is the Sheldon Ranch, which is warmer. And we're about done there. And we're going to switch to our East End Ranch, which is cooler. And so there will be a shift from super sweet to a little bit more acidic here in a couple weeks when we change where we're picking them.
Yeah, Chef Naomi, she joked, she's like, I don't know what they are putting in their soil to make these tangerines so sweet and juicy. Is there something in the soil? Like what about where you guys grow the tangerines makes them so unique or maybe affects their flavor? Can you tell me about that?
All citrus likes a pretty rocky soil. You don't want the wet clay soil. All citrus loves heat. So you want some hot summer and some cool nights. That makes a difference. But it probably has more to do with the microclimate than the actual soil itself. Whether it's a south slope or a north slope, that makes some difference. As I say, they like heat, so they like south side, west side of if it's hilly. And our ranches tend to be hilly in Ojai.
Because the skin is so delicate, do you think you could just eat it like an apple and like eat the skin too?
People do. I've got customers that put the whole thing in their blender with their juice, you know. They don't have seeds, so you don't get the seed pieces. And yeah, you can just definitely juice the whole thing or slice it thinly and throw the whole thing at the end of a stir fry. The peel is really flavorful.
The other thing I would emphasize is for people to come by, now that we're allowed to give samples again, and you can taste, we got several, four different kinds of tangerines today. They all have slightly different flavors. Pixies are great for kids because they're small and they're really low acid, so you can eat, you know, five or six of them at a time.
So you said before that the Tahoe Gold tangerines, they're good now, like March, April. This is pretty late for citrus. Is this like the kind of the latest citrus that you guys grow, or is there anything else that comes afterwards?
No, well, we have two varieties right now that are a little bit later than this variety. The one's the Ojai Pixie, and then we have a W. Murcott. It's a fairly common type of tangerine, but we'll be able to sell those all the way through the summer. A couple of times we've actually lapped them all the way till we start the next season, which is Satsumas, would be the early fall. Try to have tangerines year-round. Of course, we have oranges and lemons and other things year-round as well.
Whenever you guys are at home cooking for yourselves, how do you like to use the tangerines just in your day-to-day?
I mostly just eat tangerines out of hand, and I've got two children, 12 and 14-year-old, and they literally come home from school and eat I don't know how many tangerines and oranges. And even over Christmas break, I couldn't find my daughter one day. She's 12. She's not the biggest person, and I couldn't find her. Where'd she go? She'd taken the flashlight, gone all the way to the back of the orchard where her favorite trees are. They're totally spoiled. And, you know, they make their own juice. If I don't bring juice home from the packing house, they'll squeeze up a bunch of juice. And, of course, I love my juice and my cocktails. Just our straight orange juice with a wedge of tangerine in it and add gin, and that's my favorite cocktail.
Well, thank you so much, Tony. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
That was Tony Thatcher and Emily Ayala of Friends Ranch in Ojai. For the Market Report, this is Ben Mims.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, and Nick Lamponi. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. For Passover, my standby recipe is a substitute for gefilte fish. Instead, I make the Italian pesce and carpione, fish fillets dredged in matzo meal, then fried in oil, and marinated in a mustard vinaigrette made with copious amounts of a Dijon vinaigrette. Enjoy your time with family and friends, however you celebrate, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.